Hello. I'm delighted to welcome you to this public lecture on the human rights of people with disabilities. My name is Dr. Jenny Cooper. I'm a research fellow at London School of Economics, and I'm on the advisory board of the Human Rights Centre, and I'll be chairing this lecture. The lecture comes at a time when the human rights of people with disabilities is at last appearing on the international agenda, and we're going to talk about recent developments in the UN and also within Europe, and we're also going to look at some of the wider issues. Unfortunately, Dr. Richard Light is not able to be with us tonight, but we do have some other very distinguished speakers. There's Anna Lawson and Professor Helen Meenan and Dr. Nick O'Brien. They're each going to speak for about 10 minutes, and then there will be time for questions and answers. And after that, you're invited to join us all for drinks, and we can continue the discussion informally. So the first speaker is Anna Lawson. She's a lecturer in the law school at Leeds University and a member of the University Centre for Disability Studies. Her research interests focus on disability and law, including discrimination law and human rights. She's acted as a consultant for the UK's Disability Rights Commission, and she's taken part in various related projects in Europe. Her publications include a recent book on disability rights in Europe. Someone else, David, will be reading her quotes because her braille is too slow. So it's over to Anna Lawson now.
Disability is a human rights issue. I repeat, disability is a human rights issue. Those of us who happen to have a disability are fed up of being treated by society and our fellow citizens as if we did not exist or as if we were aliens from outer space. We are human beings with equal value, claiming equal rights.
It may surprise some of you here tonight to learn that those words were spoken as recently as 2000 by the UN Special Rapporteur with responsibility for disability. However, disability traditionally hasn't been regarded as a human rights issue. The disability movement has worked tirelessly for the last three decades to counter the assumption that a person with an impairment, if they can't be cured or corrected to fit into mainstream society, should remain an outsider dependent on welfare and charity for their basic existence. The disability movement has argued that disabled people should be valued as equals, and as equals, they should be entitled to enjoy the same human rights enjoyed by others. And it's from that conviction that the emerging UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities was born. I'm going to say a few more words about that convention, but before I do that, I'm going to devote a few words to the extent of the problem, the extent of the exclusion and isolation experienced by disabled people. I'm then going to have a section on the response of the UN to the exclusion experienced by disabled people. And then I'm going to have a third substantive section which will pick out a couple of the ongoing issues which are still to be dealt with by the process involved in elaborating that convention. So turning now to the first of those three substantive sections, the extent of the problem. There are an estimated 600 million disabled people in the world, 70% of whom live in developing countries. The link between poverty and disability is very well established. Disabled people disproportionately are being found in the poorest sections of all societies. Studies such as the one commissioned by the UN in 1991 and written by Leandro Despuy reveal a shocking extent of marginalisation and deprivation. And those results, sadly, continue to emerge from more recent surveys. The most recent surveys that I've come across on this are the ones produced by the International Disability Rights Monitor Project. And I'll just give you a few of the facts that report, well, the first of those reports dealing with 24 countries in the Americas reveals. That report indicates that in most of the countries covered, disabled people were at risk of being declared legally incompetent, with the consequence that they lost all their rights, including the right to liberty. The most common reason for that was mental impairment, but sensory impairments such as blindness and deafness also led to such declarations in some places. For those people who ended up living in institutions because of their disability, the report reveals a series of shocking human rights violations, including the fact that people were living in rooms soiled with their feces, they were denied clothing, and they were forced to eat off the ground. In some countries, disabled people were kept in jail for decades because it was thought that they were unable to attend court because it was inaccessible. As regards education, an estimated 20 to 30% of children, disabled children, went to school, any form of school, across the region. So 70%, more than 70% were excluded from education. And only 30% of disabled people were estimated to find employment on average. And even for those 30%, poverty was often inescapable. For a third of them, they were paid less than the minimum wage in many of the countries, and many of them received no wages at all for their work. I could spend the whole 10 minutes on the report, but it's the results are very well summed up by William Kennedy Smith, who founded the International Disability Network.
The sad fact is that few countries show signs of thinking about or planning to include people with disabilities in national life. People with disabilities are often invisible, ignored by policymakers and planners, warehoused in institutions, forgotten, neglected, and frequently abused.
Right, moving on then to the second substantive section, which is the response of the UN. I've divided this into three. The first question is, why do we need a disability convention? Because, as many of us will know, many of the rights conferred by the International Human Rights Framework are universal in nature. They apply to everybody, including disabled people. So disabled people, like everybody else, should be entitled to the right to life, the right to be free from torture and inhuman and degrading treatment, the right to associate with others, the right to vote. They should also be entitled to such economic and social rights as the right to health, housing, and education. Despite the fact that these rights are theoretically available to disabled people at the moment and have been for many years, there's been growing concern about the mismatch between the theory and the practice. The extent of this match is very well documented in an extremely influential report written by Gerard Quinn and Thérèse Dejeuner in 2002, which is worth following up if anyone's interested. they point to the fact that disabled people have become invisible in human rights law. Despite the fact that they should be entitled to these rights, they're not actually being awarded to them in practice. And this point was echoed in February this year by Louise Arbour, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, who said,
"There is no doubt that the existing human rights system was meant to promote and protect the rights of persons with disabilities. There is also no doubt that the existing standards and mechanisms have, in fact, failed to provide adequate protection in the specific case of persons with disabilities. It is clearly time for the United Nations to remedy this shortcoming."
Okay. So the second point under the response of the UN is what's happened with this convention so far, the progress of the Disability Convention. In February 2002, the General Assembly adopted a resolution which set up an ad hoc committee to investigate proposals for a disability-specific convention. That committee has now met 7 times. The last time they met was January to February this year. And they're planning to meet again in August. That's scheduled to be their last meeting, so they're hoping that by the 24th of August the text will be more or less finalised. After that, it would simply remain for the convention to be adopted and ratified. So, what about the content of this convention? I can't give a comprehensive account of it, but I thought it might be helpful just to give you an example of a few of the issues it deals with, just to give you an idea of its scope. Article 5 of it covers equality and non-discrimination and would require all signatory states to implement anti-disability discrimination law. It would also oblige them to take appropriate measures to ensure that disabled people were given reasonable accommodation or adjustments wherever necessary. Article 15 of the Convention concerns independent living, and it would give disabled people the right to choose where they lived. It would give them the right not to be subjected to compulsory institutionalisation simply on the grounds of their impairment. And it also provides that if they choose to live in the community, states should be obliged to take reasonable steps to provide them with support that they needed to live independently. Article 25 concerns health, and it would grant to disabled people the right to receive the same health services as are provided to the rest of the population. And also, it would oblige states to provide disabled people with specific health services relating to their impairment. Article 23 relates to marriage and family life, and would give disabled people the right to marry on the same basis as others, the right to retain their fertility, and the right to become parents, and would oblige states to provide them with some support in their parenting role if that was needed. Article 20 concerns personal mobility, and it would oblige states to take steps to facilitate the mobility of disabled people by measures such as providing them with aids at a reasonable cost or training, mobility training at a reasonable cost. Turning then to the final section, which is ongoing issues, and I haven't again identified all of the issues because there isn't time, but just an example of a few. First one is the standard at which the rights are to be set. The whole point of this convention isn't to grant disabled people new rights, it's to ensure that they have access to universal rights, rights which everybody else enjoys. It's therefore vital that the standard set for their rights in this new convention is comparable to that enjoyed by everybody else. If that standard is set lower than the standard that other rights are enjoyed, it's going to defeat the purpose of the convention. And this is a concern that many of the many disability activists have, including Richard Light, who sadly isn't here. But he is the UK's disabled persons representative on the ad hoc committee. And you can look at his reports of the discussions in that committee on the web. He indicates a few particular areas of concern, one of which is Article 17.4, which regulates but permits forceful interventions with disabled people, such as maybe forcefully giving somebody a cochlear implant, even if they didn't want one, or giving them leg braces when they would prefer to use a wheelchair. That creates a risk that whereas non-disabled people's wishes might be respected, they could have a right to their wishes being respected, disabled people won't have a right to their wishes being respected in the same way. Second ongoing issue is monitoring. It's widely recognised by supporters of a convention that its success is going to hang on effective monitoring, on having an effective monitoring system, its own body, with the full involvement of disabled people. Detailed discussions are happening on this in the 8th session of the ad hoc committee in August, but in the preliminary discussions on this in the 7th session in February, there were indications that agreement wasn't going to be easily reached. There was particular concern that the United States and also Australia were supporting the mainstreaming of monitoring amongst existing monitoring bodies rather than the setting up of a new monitoring body for this convention. So that's the debate to have in the 8th session in August. Oh, right. The third one is definition of disability, which in this last meeting they agreed that disability should be defined despite the advice of the chair. So that difficult task of defining disability is again to be gone through. To conclude, one of the main purposes of the convention, this new convention, has been to raise the visibility of disability as a human rights issue. To some extent, the process of elaborating that convention has helped to achieve this aim. It's certainly raised the profile of disability as a human rights issue throughout the globe. However, the convention has the potential to do an awful lot more in protecting and promoting the rights of disabled people. I'm going to conclude with the words of Disabled Peoples International, who recognise that this period between the 7th and the 8th meetings of the ad hoc committee were critical for advocates of the convention. And they go on to say,
though the draft convention is nearly finalised, there remains both the potential to improve it and the danger that it may be compromised. We must be vigilant, positive, and focused to ensure the continued momentum toward our definition of success, a voice of our own, and the opportunity for that voice to be heard through the recognition of our rights in every country on the planet.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for that excellent introduction, which shows how important this particular moment is for these debates. The next speaker is Helen Meenan. She holds the Jean Monnet Chair at Kingston University and originally graduated from University College Dublin, worked as a solicitor there, and after getting her master's in law, she taught in The Hague and in Ireland. She joined Kingston Law School in 1997, and her research interests include age discrimination, human rights, elder law, European company law, and European social policy. She's spoken at many national and international events and is now involved in writing a book on European equality law.
Good evening, everyone. Firstly, I would like to thank Anna for her presentation, which struck me very forcibly, the links between the disabled world and the age world, issues of visibility, issues of poverty, and so on. I would also like to thank Professor Geertie for his kind invitation to speak here this evening. It's a particular honour to speak at a Centre for Human Rights, which embraces both over there notions of human rights and on your own doorstep notions of human rights. Arguably, discrimination falls nicely within this second category, as it helps to tackle the horrors at our workplace, horrors in society, and most importantly of all, horrors in our own hearts. Disability, however, as a broad issue, neatly links the over here and on your doorstep worlds. And this is brought home very forcibly from Anna reminding us that 500 million of the 600 million disabled people worldwide are in the developing world. Now, one of the contexts within which the convention has been drafted is massive demographic change. Our world is evolving into an older world. The UN Convention, as far as I can see, does not refer to the context of demographic aging. It does not refer to an age perspective. However, it mentions age and age-related terms some 9 times, and that's not to mention its very important references to children. I have 2 simple tasks tonight, and I'm going to try and achieve them very simply. The first is to establish the nexus between age and disability. The second is to situate disability among the diversity of all the grounds. All the grounds covered by Article 13 of the European Community Treaty. So, I would like to suggest that age can be used as a door through which we all have an interest in disability. This is firstly because age is potentially the most diverse ground of all. Age embraces all other grounds, including disability. And of course, one of the most persuasive arguments for a link between age and disability is the context of population aging, the context of massive demographic change. This establishes a nexus beyond inclusiveness. What we're going to see is the number of people aged over 60 worldwide will double from 600 million in 2001 to 1.2 billion by 2025. And again, the developing world already has 2/3 of the over 60s. Our longer lives mean that people with disabilities too are living longer, and more people are growing into disability or impairment with age as they reach older ages. We learn that in 2002, nearly 30% of the European Union population aged between 55 and 64 reported a long-standing health problem or disability. We know that less than half disabled people in the EU are employed. The European Commission, among many others, maintained there is a strong correlation between disability and increasing age. A study commissioned by the European Commission states as follows: the clearest and most consistent relationship across countries is between age and disability. Higher age groups have a higher share of disability. The Age Reference Group on Equality and Human Rights has very helpfully helped us to navigate the nexus between age and other grounds. It suggests various ways in which multiple discrimination occurs. For example, when those suffering discrimination already grow old. Age discrimination also compounds other forms of inequality. It specifically tells us, identifies, two categories of people for whom age and disability overlap. Those who acquire impairment after state pension age, but they may not necessarily see themselves as disabled. And those who have acquired impairments earlier in life and have then grown older. Thus, age is a door through which long-standing and newly disabled persons belong to the biggest group of all, age. And it's important to stress that age encompasses all age groups, young and old. My second task is to situate disability among the diversity of grounds. This is partially been done. I will use discrimination law as the door through which we do this. A few years ago, Christopher McCrudden expressed the view that European equality was in the course of being subsumed within a broader human rights discourse. Within the EU, as we know, Article 13 of the EC Treaty enables the European Union to combat discrimination on grounds of sex, racial or ethnic origin, religion or belief, disability, age and sexual orientation. This has gone a long way to situating age and disability among the diversity of grounds. Broadly speaking, all the Article 13 grounds share a common core of provisions in respect of discrimination in employment. However, we know that there are two branches within the Article 13 family. Race and sex occupy one branch for which there is protection in and outside the workplace from discrimination. The remaining grounds, including age and disability, occupy the other branch. So employment, discrimination in employment is where they all meet. However, even within employment, age and disability are treated differently. Firstly, there's a special provision allowing member states to justify direct age discrimination. For example, maximum or minimum recruitment ages. In the name of legitimate employment policy, labour market, or vocational training objectives, as long as the means used are proportionate. Secondly, as we know, the employment directive requires employers in Article 5 to take appropriate measures where needed in a particular case to enable a person with a disability to have access to, participate in, or advance in employment or undergo training, unless such measures would impose a disproportionate burden on the employer. This obligation on the employer to take appropriate action where needed in a particular case implies a specific response to the individual disabled employee, implies an individualized or personalized response. This leads us back to age and to age-related conditions from whatever source. In 1999, Gerard Quinn suggested that the classic anti-discrimination model did not work optimally for disability or age. He saw no reason why reasonable accommodation could not be used for age as well. More recently, Marie-Ange Moreau has suggested that adjustment measures for disabled people be extended to all underrepresented groups. It's difficult to see why this cannot be the case, especially for age. Applying reasonable accommodation for age helps us to deal with those situations where there is a real need that can be met. It provides a workable alternative to the maximum and minimum recruitment ages, etc., that are permitted by the directive. The idea that all older workers be treated in a homogeneous fashion, as though they all had the same physical abilities, or that they are stereotyped as to have the same slowness that is perceived as coming with age, the same resistance to change as perceived as coming with age, is wrong. It fails the use of chronological age to provide cutoffs in the workplace, fails to take account of the vast differences in functional ability, even between people of the same age, even in the same sector. In 2002, the Irish Equality Authority recommended in a report implementing equality for older people, that the multiple identities of older people suggest that equality strategies for older people take into account different groups of older men and older women. Equally, equality strategies for other groups must take into account the situation, experience, and identity of older persons within that group. I would like to commend that approach very forcibly to this House, but to suggest that instead of older, we look at subgroups within each of our movements, within each of the groups we adhere to find those that intersect with other grounds. This will help us to see the rich diversity of grounds we inhabit and how our ground weaves through all the others. We may be neglecting some subgroup at the moment. I suggest it is only in this way that we can begin to achieve commitment to freedom for all. I would like to suggest that the UN Convention would optimally emphasize an age as well as a gender perspective in promoting the rights of older people, especially in the face of demographic aging, which will hopefully affect us all. But closer to home, away from New York, I would like to paraphrase William Butler Yeats and say that let us hope, let no one say, that is no country for old men or for persons with disabilities about our countries. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for another interesting contribution. And the last speaker is Dr. Nick O'Brien. He's Director of Legal Services and Operations at the Disability Rights Commission in Manchester, where he has overall responsibility for the strategic legal work and the helpline and other initiatives, which he may talk about. Prior to this, he was the Deputy Legal Services Ombudsman for England and Wales. He's been a solicitor since 1987 and is a member of the steering group for the Planned Commission for Equality and Human Rights. He's written extensively, including about disability rights.
One of the particularly pleasing things about tonight's event is its recognition of the journey taken by disabled people, a journey from welfare to rights, from a medical model of disability that sees impairment as the problem, to a social model which highlights instead the failure of the social, economic, and cultural environment to accommodate impairment. And perhaps now also from that social model to something rather more like Amartya Sen's and Martha Nussbaum's capability model, which sees the aim of liberal politics as that of providing support for human need so that all human beings, including disabled people, can choose to function. But what sort of rights should we aspire to in this context? Are the anti-discrimination norms favoured by the Domestic Disability Discrimination Act of 1995, the DDA, are those rights sufficient? Or is the very different-looking human rights approach, whether that of the European Convention on Human Rights, now incorporated into the Domestic Human Rights Act, or of the revised European Social Charter, which at Article 15 provides for the independence, social integration, and participation in the life of the community of disabled people, or again, the draft UN Convention, which we've heard described, with its largely principled insistence on independent living and participation? Is that different human rights approach a necessary complement to anti-discrimination law, and in fact a better bet for achieving anything like substantive equality for disabled people? More specifically, and from the perspective of the Disability Rights Commission, the DRC, the statutory body established here by government in April 2000 to promote and enforce disability rights, especially as enshrined in the DDA, and incidentally the statutory body which has been expressly refused powers by successive secretaries of state to bring standalone human rights cases on disability issues. From that perspective, I want to talk about three things. First, I want to draw upon the DRC's own litigation experience and its observation of litigation in this area more generally to suggest that in the context of disability rights, a human rights framework does indeed complement and enlarge a narrower approach based just on conventional anti-discrimination law. Secondly, I want to suggest that this complementarity has something to do with what might be described as the uniquely positive accent in which disability rights law is enunciated, its distinctive requirement that employers and others do not just in some crudely symmetrical and neatly rationalistic way treat disabled people the same as everyone else, but that they take positive steps, make reasonable adjustments, to use the jargon, to achieve substantive equality for disabled employees, students and pupils, customers and clients. And finally, I want to suggest that it is precisely this positive accent that gives us a clue to the sort of pivotal role that disability rights might have in the future development of anti-discrimination law more generally, and within the practice of the planned Commission for Equality and Human Rights, which will most likely come into effect in October of next year. This analysis suggests that far from being the poor relation, disability is in fact well placed to shape the future practice and discourse of anti-discrimination and human rights law. So let's start with the Disability Rights Commission, the DRC. Its very existence is a reflection of a profound shift, a shift that has seen the disadvantage experienced by disabled people become not so much a source of pity as of indignation, a matter of justice and rights rather than of charity and welfare, of participation and empowerment rather than of benefits and patronage. A tangible sign of that shift is the Disability Discrimination Act, the DDA, of which the DRC is in a sense the guardian. Although a major symbolic breakthrough based largely on the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, the domestic DDA was greeted with some skepticism by parts of the disability movement. First, its medical model definition of disability, in other words, its preoccupation with what is wrong with disabled people rather than what is wrong with the social setup, opened the door to protracted litigation about who precisely is protected by the law. Does it cover people with dyslexia, those with bad backs, those who are depressed for 6 month spells but never quite for a whole 12 months in a row, and so on. Secondly, the balancing act between the needs of disabled people and the demands of business made for a relatively low justification threshold, and certainly for a useful negotiating tool on the part of business when it came to settling cases before trial. And even more importantly, the scope and reach of the DDA was heavily circumscribed by block-booking exceptions from coverage, the most relevant in this context being the effective exclusion of all public functions, something only to be remedied in December of this year. The result is that whilst the DDA has been a useful tool in certain employment and consumer disputes, it has left largely untouched whole swathes of public sector service delivery, such as health, transport, social care, and even education, covered by the DDA just since 2002. In other words, precisely those areas where protection is most needed if disabled people are to flourish socially, economically, and culturally, and where anyway it would take something more positive than mere non-discrimination, with its comparative dimension, its insistence upon finding comparators, to make a real difference. In its early days, the DRC, and indeed disabled litigants more generally, as a result, found itself involved in cases that turned on just these issues. Was the individual really disabled at all? And if so, prove it. Surely health and safety factors justify such and such an employment practice. Can a tea shop in Harrogate really be expected to make room for a wheelchair? Can non-disabled golfers in Surrey sleep soundly in their beds when they know the next day they'll be pitted against a disabled golfer in a buggy instead of carrying his own clubs like them? Important though these issues were, the question inevitably arose, was this all that it had been about? All the campaigning, the lobbying, the sit-ins. Did this relatively compressed employment and consumer agenda really do justice to the complexity of disabled people's lives and to the real scale of the historical disadvantage encountered? And so enter human rights as one possible source of deliverance. By intervening in a series of human rights cases, not DDA cases at all, but very often cases central to the independent living agenda of disabled people, and by appealing to human rights principles, especially those developed under Articles 3 and 8 of the European Convention, the DRC has been able to reach beyond the DDA and its limitations. So, when two young disabled women wanted to challenge the decision of East Sussex County Council to take them into residential care because its health and safety practice entailed a no-lifting policy in the home, it was human rights principles and not the DDA that came to the rescue. When Leslie Burke wanted to challenge the General Medical Council's guidance to doctors on the withdrawal of artificial nutrition and hydration, it was to human rights principles that he instinctively turned for ammunition. And when a disabled child developed asthma and was effectively denied the necessary ventilation on quality of life grounds, it was human rights principles which informed her parents' determination to demand what was needed from another hospital and which enabled them to reach agreement with the first hospital about what had gone wrong. In the East Sussex case, the judge, the High Court judge, Mr. Justice Mumby, placed the argument firmly within the jurisprudence developed by the European Court of Human Rights when he remarked, "True it is that the phrase human dignity is not used in the Convention, but it is surely immanent in Article 8, indeed in almost every one of the Convention's provisions. The recognition and protection of human dignity is one of the core values, in truth the core value, of our society, and indeed of all societies which are part of the European family of nations and which have embraced the principles of the Convention. The other important concept embraced in the physical and psychological integrity protected by Article 8 is the right of the disabled person to participate in the life of the community. This is matched by the positive obligation of the state to take appropriate measures designed to ensure, to the greatest extent feasible, that a disabled person is not so circumscribed and so isolated as to be deprived of the possibility of developing his personality." The words of Mr. Justice Mumby. So what these human rights cases had in common was the desire to get public authorities to accept that they have positive obligations towards disabled people. This was not just a matter of human rights as a series of keep-out notices to church and state, a manifestation of an enlightenment or rather narrow civil liberties agenda. Instead, this was something more positive, entailing a sense of positive value and the need for certain positive interventions that would be necessary if the disabled people in question were to have any meaningful freedom of choice, any meaningful prospects of social inclusion and participation. The fact that they were not always completely successful in their arguments, although by and large they were successful, is not the absolute point. Human rights principles, more probably than black-letter human rights law, still less black-letter anti-discrimination law, provided a language and a framework within which the arguments could be articulated and given their due weight. And as it happens, such an approach sits well with and builds upon the most productive and distinctive parts of the DDA. Its reasonable adjustment provisions. It's those provisions that recognise, albeit imperfectly, that for disabled people, equality is not about formally equal treatment at all, not about some neatly symmetrical notion of equality of opportunity, but in fact about something more ambitious, about difference of treatment to achieve something a little more like substantive equality. Baroness Hale made the point well when in the recent House of Lords DDA case of Archibald against Fife Council, she said that unlike the Sex Discrimination Act and the Race Relations Act, the DDA does not see treating everyone the same as the answer, but instead accepts, realistically, that different treatment is actually the path to real equality. And the same positive approach emerges too in the new disability equality duty, which will come into force on public authorities from December this year, and which provides that they must take account of disabled people's situations, even where that involves treating disabled people more favourably than others. In fact, it is recognised, I think, that both the Sex Discrimination Act and the Race Relations Act also need the inclusion of more positive provisions if they are to have real impact. The Race Relations Amendment Act already, in response to the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, introduces a positive duty on the public sector. And the Equality Act, passed just a couple of weeks ago, paves the way for a similar duty on gender. Elsewhere, in Canada, for example, the reasonable adjustment duty has been applied to all the prohibited grounds of discrimination, with the human rights concept of dignity being used as a moderator that avoids a comparative approach and instead tests against a common substantive benchmark. So where does this leave the future of equality in human rights law? This coalition of positive human rights obligations and what I've called the positive accent of the DDA, its reasonable adjustment provisions and the new public sector duty, is not just of parochial interest. The government's decision to review discrimination law and to create a new Commission for Equality and Human Rights raises fundamental questions about the purpose and effectiveness of anti-discrimination law, about the relationship between human rights and equality, and about the sort of equality that might carry positive value and not just pleasingly neat and formal symmetry. Last week we heard that the Commission on Women and Work had confirmed what everyone knew, namely that after 25 years of the Sex Discrimination Act, the pay gap is still huge. Yet what the Commission failed to conclude, albeit controversially, was that the continuing problem lies primarily with individual discriminatory acts on the part of employers, with breaches of the well-established and much-litigated law in this area. Instead, it looked to more systemic and positive solutions. What I've suggested here is that the DRC's experience invites the conclusion that the achievement of substantive equality for disabled people will entail a continued interpretation of anti-discrimination law within a human rights framework, informed and enlarged by human rights principles, and perhaps even occasionally by human rights law. But the lessons do not stop with disabled people, but provide pointers for all seriously disadvantaged social groups to the sort of strategies that might help. And that such a positive approach does not lead in the direction of some sort of politically correct tyranny, but instead to the only version of liberalism worth having. A liberalism that is not about negative freedom alone, about freedom from discrimination and irrationality, but about something more ambitious, about dignity and equal worth, about the positive freedom to flourish and participate. To realise the human rights of disabled people, in that case, simply is one way of furthering equality and that positive liberty for everyone, whether disabled or not. And that, in my view, is an opportunity not to be squandered lightly. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for all the very interesting information from these three speakers. I've been a bit indulgent with the time because they seem to have a lot to say and also had to speak fairly slowly so the speech-to-text writer could follow them. But we now have about 20 minutes for questions and answers, and then there will be drinks, as I mentioned. I'd appreciate if you could keep your questions fairly short so that we can hear as many people as possible. And also, please say who you are. We'll take maybe two or three questions together and let the speakers answer them. And there are some roving microphones, so you will get a microphone before you ask your question. Yeah.
Well, one of my worries about sort of like human rights for disabled people is the actual cost of disabled equipment. Like, for instance, a chair called an iBot, which would actually enable somebody to not only get through your front doors but also to get on stage, is 20 £2,000. And a hoist that gets my partner into bed at night is £10,000. And most of the equipment's actually made in Switzerland. And I was wondering, how can there be sort of like disabled rights if the equipment is actually so expensive that no disabled person can afford it?
We'll have another question. These two here, maybe we'll take these two questions and then let the panel respond.
Hello. Hi, yeah, John Horan from Cloisters, disabled barrister. I am, as Anna knows, currently acting for an Trinidadian disabled individual in his Trinidad case, where he is arguing that currently existing anti-discrimination law on an international law has the effect of including him as a disabled person, and has the effect of meaning the government must take reasonable steps to avoid any differential treatment for his case, i.e., he must be allowed to enter and exit the doors of the High Court in Trinidad while in his wheelchair, which he can't currently do. I wondered if the panel had any idea why apparently that has been litigated in the 40 years that it's been on the international rule books under the European Convention on the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights. Is it just the costs? There seems to be no disabled person who's litigated the point at all.
There was one more question here for this round, and then we'll take next round of questions after this.
This is for the whole panel, but specifically for Nick, who works at the DRC.
Could you introduce yourself, sorry?
Sorry, Mary Fitzgerald. From GovNet. I noticed that you were on the steering group for the creation of the new CEHR, Commission for Equality and Human Rights. And my question was, how do you think all the commissions that the CEHR is going to cover, how those issues intersect each other and how they will work together and what benefits will be of having a single organisation in the future?
Well, could the panel answer those questions? Maybe we'll start with Anna to see which questions she wants to answer and move down. Helen and Nick could then answer.
Right. Sorry. I just realised... Oh, is that working? Yeah. Okay, thank you. Apologies if the microphone wasn't working while I was talking. I hope it was. Thank you for those questions. The first one is a really important question, I think, and it's one that has exercised the ad hoc committee quite a lot. It's worth having a look. The reference I made to Louise Arbour was in a statement that she made to the ad hoc committee on, I think it was the 27th of February, but anyway, it's on the website of the UN. And she spends quite a lot of time talking about the issue of resources and rights, and in the particular context of disability. But she stresses there that rights always cost money in some degree, and that it's the resource argument shouldn't be allowed to prevent progress towards the ideal. It may mean that some things can't be achieved immediately, but anti-discrimination can be achieved fairly immediately, that's the idea, and then reasonable accommodation type issues, issues that would cost more money, would be more gradually introduced. And I think it's also worth mentioning that given the huge numbers of disabled people in developing countries, where it's not specific to the question that was asked, sorry, I'm using it as a platform to move on, but where new transport systems, new buildings are being designed, it's so much cheaper to have them built in an accessible way from the outset than having to change them later on. So in that respect, the resources argument works, you know, towards making things from the beginning on the basis of universal design. Finally on that, just to note that in the draft convention, there is actually a few clauses stressing the obligation on states to make aids available, to take such measures as they can to make aids available to disabled people at an affordable price, and to develop research into producing new aids that are as similar as possible to mainstream aids, so therefore the cost would be reduced of providing them. So there may be some support there. And then the question from John, very interesting question again. I really don't know, but it's worth, there was an analogous case of Hamilton versus Jamaica, which I know we've talked about before, but that was about a disabled man who had mobility difficulties, and he was kept in death row in Jamaica, I think it was, in a prison that hadn't been adapted for him at all. So he wasn't able to use the bed, and he wasn't able to slop out his cell. And it was, he challenged that under the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights and succeeded. And the same principle of providing reasonable accommodation to those types of services, I think, would apply. So, and also there's another case which was brought under the European Convention of Human Rights. I think it's Malone versus the UK, but I've been racking my brain to think of the name, and therefore I really missed the third question. But she challenged, she brought exactly that argument against the UK. She was being tried in a UK court which wasn't accessible and had to endure significant pain as a result of not being able to bring her wheelchair into the court and not being able to use the toilet facilities. But she lost on the grounds that she didn't give the court adequate notice that she needed an accessible courtroom. So not a very inspiring case, that one. I'm afraid I missed the third question because I was thinking...
The third question was for Nick specifically, yeah. So don't worry about it. seemed to be, but anyway, we'll move on to Helen.
I'll just respond to two of the issues. The first, of course, is to state the obvious, that what adjustments are made for disabled people are of vast support and assistance to often other groups, pregnant women, people with children, young children, etc. And I work on a hill, in a university on a hill, that is a building site at the moment to try and make it disability friendly to comply with the Act. And I only wish it had been that way when I laboured between two far distant poles of the campus when I was heavily pregnant and no lifts were working. So there is enormous benefit for everyone, and I do sympathise with the issues that you raise. I sympathise enormously. As regards the new equality body, the new commission, I'm not a spokesperson for the age group, the age movement, but I think that the new grounds probably appreciate being part of it from an early stage enormously. As a lot of people here will know, there was tremendous debate what to do at the new grounds over the last few years. Who should take them? Did anybody want this or that ground? And so on. And there were limitations as to who should go where. maybe age didn't want to go with such and such a grant. Maybe there were perceived difficulties with that. So it's an enormously positive step to have all the grants together. And I think the UK should be rightly proud of setting up this commission at this point in time. Yes, it does have a model already in Northern Ireland, as we know, but the European directives only require a promotional body for race and now sex. So it is a win for the other four grounds to be part of this common body at this point in time. But I'm sure Nick will give us a lot more depth on that. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, the first question about the cost of the equipment. I mean, I suppose the first thing to say is that in fact, a lot of adjustments that disabled people need are not expensive, and that's important because very often, I think, businesses and employers assume the worst, and actually many changes that are necessary have no cost attached at all. When the Disability Discrimination Act introduced its physical features changes in 2004, the research that we commissioned showed actually that contrary to the many stories that were circulating about church halls being closed down because nobody could afford to make the changes, that actually the average cost of the adjustments that were going to be required were in the hundreds of pounds very often and not the thousands. But nevertheless, clearly, I mean, your point is valid, and I think, I mean, it brings home the fact that certainly in the case of disability equality, the law has limits, and indeed many of the solutions are, I think, probably political and economic, and there has to be that political and economic debate. And we see this, I think, currently with the debate that's going on about benefits and welfare reform. Processes like the access to work system work inadequately, although they can at their best be very effective. So I think the question brings home really the context, of the broader context within which legal remedies and legal instruments have to be set. Legal remedies are clearly only part of the solution. I think what we're talking about tonight is trying to make them a more effective part of the solution, but they can never be the entire solution, I don't think, certainly not on disability. As far as access to justice in Trinidad is concerned, I don't know what the answer to that is. I do know, though, that here, I think one of the early cases under the Human Rights Act involved a disabled man who brought a claim against, a judicial review claim against Isleworth Crown Court, I think, for the way in which his needs hadn't been accommodated on the day of trial. And I think that went to the question of listing, and he'd been kept waiting and such like. So I mean, there certainly have been successful actions here. I'm also conscious of the case of Price against the UK, again, a European case which involved a thalidomide woman who was in prison and was exposed to extremely degrading treatment as a result of being in a wheelchair, and there was no satisfactory accommodation. That case was won. And I'm also conscious of the fact that the Disability Rights Commission, very often in bringing cases on behalf of disabled people, and I'm thinking here particularly of some deaf clients we've had and clients with cognitive impairments, that we have been successful in getting tribunals and courts to make changes to their processes, soft changes, admittedly not necessarily physical changes, but soft changes, which I suspect did involve quite a culture change on their part, allowing people into the courtroom before the day of trial to get a sense of what it was going to be like giving evidence, making available alternative rooms so that if there needed to be more breaks than usual during the proceedings, that people could be accommodated. So, I mean, I think there is a sign that the access to justice issue for disabled people here is now being taken seriously. I know from discussions with the Department for Constitutional Affairs that is the case. So maybe we need to transport something useful to Trinidad, which perhaps we haven't always done in the past. On the CHR, the benefits, I think you wanted to know what the benefits were. Yeah, it's good to have a question about the benefits because people normally ask about the drawbacks. So, okay, I won't even mention the drawbacks, which perhaps are not so obvious. Some of them are. I mean, I think the first thing to say is, I mean, there is provides the opportunity for a united front on many common issues. Yes, of course, there are differences. And, you know, I have to say at the Disability Rights Commission, you know, we've made the case for a certain amount of structural difference to accommodate disability rights. So the need for a disability committee to ensure some continuity and recognition of what's different about disability. But in many areas that there are common issues, and I think if, as is accepted, I think more generally that part of the battle is to bring about a culture change in business and on the part of employers, public sector authorities, then it's unrealistic to expect them to remain attentive to a whole plethora of different debates. There needs to be some way of simplifying the approaches to make it easy for them to use what goodwill is there, and sometimes there is goodwill, and that needs to be capitalised upon. So I think the CHR provides an opportunity for doing that. But I also think the human rights framework is one of the key things, and one of the things I was trying to say too quickly and probably inadequately was that I think on disability, the human rights framework is a real plus, and I kind of have a feeling that on other strands that will be the case too. Certainly on age, I think it's fairly obvious where the connections could be there. But I think on established grounds like race and gender differentiation and sexual orientation, that there are clear possibilities here for using a human rights framework and human rights principles to embrace a concept of equality that is more substantive than some of the rather formal sort of tick box types of approaches to equality that we've seen coming from just an anti-discrimination approach. And I suppose finally there's the possibility, which may be slightly idealistic but I think it's genuine and real and can be achieved, of using human rights to try and mediate between the conflicting ambitions of different social groups. The little Canadian example I gave there was, I think, pertinent to that. I think, for example, we got into a terrible tangle at the DLC when we tried to fund a case about guide dogs having access to halal restaurants. And there was a question there about religious principle against disability rights, and there was no easy way around that. And we ended up in having quite extended negotiations. We got a fatwa, actually, a legal opinion from a mullah to decide the issue. In Canada, what they did was appeal to proportionality and dignity to try and resolve a similar sort of situation. And I mean, as I understand it, that led to it being accepted that guide dogs had the trump card, but that wouldn't always be the case. It wouldn't have pleased everybody. But at least there was a language for articulating the dispute and an approach that could be tried. So I think there's some of the pluses. I'm sure you could think of some more, but to start anyway.
We started sort of 5 minutes late, so I'm taking the liberty of ending 5 minutes late. And if we just take one more quick round of questions, and I'll ask the speakers to reply quite quickly as well, I'm afraid. Gentleman at the back. Yes.
Hi, Howard Taylor, LSE student. Isaiah Berlin said that positive liberty would possibly lead to tyranny, and that he preferred negative liberty, to go back to Nick's comment in his speech. From that, I'm going to say that, is there actually a severe lack of common sense in disability and human rights generally, thinking about the way in which the law in the UK works? One example is that I wanted to go and see Shakespeare a few weeks ago with a friend on a Saturday afternoon. I was told two things. One was that in the afternoon, ramps weren't available, but only in the evening. Secondly, that because the theatre had just been refurbished, which under my understanding means it should have been accessible anyway, there was only two wheelchair spaces, both of which had already been filled. And although I said I was able to not use a wheelchair space and transfer to a seat, they said that under health and safety regulation, they were only allowed two wheelchair users in the building at one time. I personally preferred it when you could decide to get out your wheelchair, ask two friends to help you up the steps, and sit in an ordinary seat and see the play. Because it seems to me that the law sometimes actually prohibits people from doing what they want to do in everyday society and participating properly. Comments on that, please, guys.
Interesting. I'll just see if there are any questions upstairs, but there aren't. Yes, the woman on the right there.
Hi, my name is Gisela Osorio. I'm studying social policy in developing countries. I would like to ask to Anne if you could explain a little bit more about how to, where is the line drawn in terms of disabilities? How do you define the disability for the convention? And for Nick, you mentioned something about not equal treatment for the disabled people, and maybe you could explain a little bit further what do you mean with that. And for all of you, if you, what's the next step once you have it in the law and that you have written this is the disabled people right, then what kind of movements and what kind of things are being done so that we can actually see this in the street?
It's going to be very hard for the panel to answer these questions quickly, I think. I'm afraid we can only have one more question, and well, I will take the upstairs. Yes, I looked upstairs. I didn't see anyone.
Sorry about that.
Fair enough. Yes, upstairs.
Hello. I'm Victor. I'm social policy. Okay, I'm a social policy student, and my question is, well, it seems to me that many people's perceptions of disability are strongly related to mobility, but what about other forms of disability like mental impediments or hearing impediments, for example? Isn't it important to have a broader and clear definition of disability which educate people and regard disability with a new perspective?
I'm going to have to ask the speakers to answer quite quickly, and we will be able to continue the discussion upstairs, so further questions can be discussed individually upstairs afterwards. Maybe we'll start with Nick this time, but you're going to have to be quick, Nick.
Okay. Well, I think the question was, does the law demonstrate a lack of common sense sometimes? Yeah, short answer, yes, obviously that is true. In the way the Sussex case I mentioned, I think there was an attempt to use human rights, actually, to bring a bit of common sense to play. Local authority saying, you know, we can't have people lifting disabled women in the home, health and safety issues. Therefore, although they've lived at home for 22 years, they've got to go into residential care, be subjected to hoists. Human rights came to their assistance, actually, and it brought an element of proportionality and common sense to that situation. So I think there's some hope. Secondly, a question about not equal treatment, what does that mean? Well, I think it means sometimes, you know, breaking the rules a little bit. I mentioned the House of Lords case about Mrs. Archibald in Fife Council. She'd been a road sweeper for many years. She became disabled. The rule was she couldn't take on a higher paid job, a clerical job, because it was against the open competition requirements. Local authority couldn't even countenance that. House of Lords said, well, you know, you've got to countenance it. It may not be the right answer. You've got to take into account various considerations, how much extra pay, how long she'd been there, such like. But, you know, sometimes you need to actually be willing to take an extra step to bring about substantive equality. And again, proportionality comes into play, I suspect. What were the advantages to her vis-a-vis the disadvantages to others? How important is the written process of policy? And not just mobility. Well, yes, of course, it's absolutely true. And I mean, that's, I think, a fundamental part of the disability rights agenda. And that's also where some of the linkages to age comes in. You know, cognitive impairment, terribly important. Sensory impairment, of course, most people think about. But disability is not just about wheelchairs. And I think, you know, that has to be prioritised and accepted. And I think the DLC has tried to do that. But we all need to be alert to that.
I'm happy to pass on to Alec and help you out. It's your turn.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take questions in the reverse order. The first one about the perception of disability. I think you're very right. You've put a very important point there. There is a tendency to have very narrow conceptions of what disability is. And I think a lot of people who are disabled find it a bit of a shock when they realise that they do come within the definition of the Disability Discrimination Act as a disabled person. Certainly a lot of my students who find out that they're disabled because they've got dyslexia or asthma, that it's a complete... They say, oh, I never thought of myself like that before. But I think it's really important not just for general societal perceptions, but also for the perceptions of disabled people themselves. It potentially strengthens the disability movement so much if it includes a wider range of people, and it's very important that instead of kind of competing for resources or demands that we all work together, and I think that's a really important issue, which has happened, I have to say. Then the next related point on the definition of disability and the convention, I'm glad you asked that because I didn't have time to go into it. There isn't a definition at the moment, and there was considerable debate about whether a definition was needed in the convention, partly because of the difficulties associated with defining disability, which we've experienced a great deal in the UK, and our definition is currently being reviewed in a big way. There are various proposals that have been suggested. None of them are the UK one, but that's going to be discussed in detail in August in the next ad hoc session. So hopefully it'll be defined in a very inclusive way, because otherwise it could raise all sorts of dangers. And turning to the first question about the theatre, although Nick's addressed it, I just wonder whether they have actually complied with the law. It may be that the theatre hasn't been sensible rather than the law in that case. It may be that if they've got a policy of only allowing two wheelchairs in, maybe it would have been a reasonable adjustment to change that if you were able to use a seat, even if there was space for only two wheelchairs. So maybe you could have a word with the Disability Rights Commission about a case later on.
Well, on that note, I'd like to make a quick announcement and then thank our speakers and ask for a round of applause for them. But first, just to let you know that the drinks are on the fifth floor of this building. There are lifts just outside this hall, so the fifth floor is accessible. People who want to walk up can do so. Everyone's welcome, and there are signposts showing you where the drinks will be. And please could we have a round of applause for our excellent speakers.